For the past 25 years, Bordeaux Index has been relentless in our focus on changing the fine wine market for collectors and investors. Today, we are the largest seller of fine wine and spirits globally. Bordeaux Index, join us and visit bordeauxindex.com.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Laura Prendergast.
And I'm Olivia Potts.
And today we're delighted to be joined by Luke Farrell. Luke is the founder of two of last year's hottest openings in the restaurant world, Plaza Calgang and Speedboat Bar, both furiously spicy Thai restaurants in central London. He spent the last 15 years living in Thailand, as well as working on his nursery, Rye Water, in Dorset, where he grows a living library of Thai ingredients in his six tropical greenhouses. Luke, welcome to Table Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Luke, we're going to start where we always do, at the beginning, and ask you, what are your earliest memories of food?
You know, I was actually asking my mum about this not so long ago, and she told me about a particular time in London's Chinatown at a restaurant called New World Restaurant. And I've been going there since I remember. It no longer exists. And when I was very small, I used to love going there and having dim sum. It's opposite the fire station there. So when I was a small boy, going up and see the fire trucks and then go and have some Chinese food, which was really a great day out, basically. And I remember sitting on one of these large, you know, those massive tables with the Lazy Susan, you know, and all of this stuff going around. And it was the crispy wontons that really got me. My mum told me that I was already ordering from the menu at this point for everyone. I knew exactly what to have: crispy duck and pancakes and wontons and shumai and har gow and all of these sorts of things. And we had those hot towels, you know, that you can dab your face with and hands before eating. And I said to the waiter, "Do you mind if we take these home? I think it's okay. We like to keep these." So I was already sort of... being the head of the table then. When I was very small, my mum followed this nutritionist or paediatrician called Christina Bruhl, who had this plan of how babies should eat, you know, little textures and flavours, things like the Stellini pasta, or, you know, eating grapes and learning how to spit out the seeds and this sort of thing. And I had a little cup, an egg cup, because I never had one of these beakers of waving around and drinks going everywhere. A little egg cup, and that has a very thick lip, which is actually for babies quite nice to drink from. So from a very early age, I already had a little chalice on the table, and the teacups in New World Restaurant were similar. So I felt very at home.
Sounds very sophisticated, baby weaning. Luke, tell us about what were mealtimes like in your family house, and what sort of food was being cooked for you?
Well, my mum is a fantastic cook, and we have our own vegetable garden. We always have, so food was very simple and fresh and from the garden. So the kitchen is the focal point of our entire home. We've got an aga in there, and I think just sort of so natural cooking on that. It's always on, you know, just things like toast cooked on the aga and a can of sardines with onions. That's one of my earliest food memories, I think, doing it myself initially. My mum sold it to me as sardines, as deep sea fishes rather than sardines. So, she got me on that one. But yeah, always been quite adventurous. The rule was, you know, you have to try it before you can say you don't like it. And I think that's in a very important way to eat. How do you know if you haven't tried it? Unfortunately, now it's gone completely the other way. My mum tells me, "Oh, don't eat that. Please don't eat that. That's not safe. That's not..." Generally, all the funky stuff that I have in Bangkok's Chinatown, and some very tricky Isan street food, and lots of offal and things that might not constitute a wholesome meal, but a delicious nevertheless. Yeah.
And did you travel much when you were a child, or when did your interest in food...
Yes,
from
the beginning. My dad is a lepidopterist, which is a butterfly expert, and he opened butterfly farms in Malaysia and traveled extensively around Southeast Asia, also in Central America and Belize. So I was always tagging along with him. So that was sort of the normal for me, was eating, you know, street food in Malaysia. And I have a Malaysian uncle who took me to eat my first fish head curry, which still stays with me as one of my most enjoyable food memories. He had it there in the restaurant, and he was giving me all the choicest bits, you know, the lips, the little fronds running down the head and the cheeks. And then we finally got to the brain inside, and he said, "Do you think I can get into this and get the brain out?" And I said, "Well, you obviously can." And he sort of sucked off the bone at the front, and then it, like a sort of key came out, and it cracked it open. And then inside was this little sort of grey globular sort of jelly type thing. And he said, "Go on, you have that." And I sort of gulped and tried it. And I thought, yeah, this is good fun. This is the way to eat. Yeah, I can't all be fillet steak. You know, this is a lot more enjoyable. So yeah, that was the norm really. And it translated back to how I like to eat at home. You know, we'd always bring things like chili seeds or some cuttings, either for the butterflies or for us back. And that's how the greenhouses started really. There's always a kind of something that we were growing that was from Malaysia or Thailand or Vietnam especially.
And do you remember when you first cooked?
I remember cooking at home, yeah, like, you know, simple things, you know, like pasta and that sort of thing. But it's only really when and at school as well, I used to cook like black pudding, and I used to have that in the mornings and like jam the extraction on and try to hide that smell out the windows and stuff. But I had, I remember when I was in halls at uni, and I was, everyone else in my halls was Korean girls. They were all studying there, and we were all sharing one fridge. And it was like just chocker full of like bulgogi sauces and kimchi and all that amazing stuff. I thought, well, I'd like to cook something for them, you know, if they like these type of flavors. So I made pad thai, and I haven't cooked that for years now thinking about it, but I used to make it all the time. And I think it's similar to everyone who leaves home. You're always on the phone back to your mum saying, "Hey, you know, I used to like eating that. How do you make that?" And then that's how it, when you have to do it by yourself, when you learn a lot more. And also the freedom to cook whatever you like as well. So we had some incredible parties in that halls. We had some really mad meals from all over the world. Yeah. I remember cooking kippers for them as well. Yeah. And stinking out the place. That seems to be a familiar theme running through my culinary career. It's basically, yeah, that sort of thing happening.
And tell us about the early stages of your career in food. I think I'm right in saying you were at Salt Yard and then at Trishna. What was that like?
So I was at design school at St Martin's, and I didn't get on with that very well. I started bartending and things like that, just earning a bit of cash to travel, basically. And then I went to the Salt Yard, and they said, "Would you like to do a day a week in the kitchen?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd like to try that." So I did that. And the first thing I cooked on that first day was a chocolate nemesis cake. Do you remember that? That was a classic. And I couldn't believe it. Like, within like, you know, an hour, I'd made a cake. It was mad. And they couldn't get me out of the kitchen after that. That was it. Stuck, wouldn't leave. And they said, "You know, it's less money and you don't get as big a share of the tips." I said, "I don't care. I just want to be in the kitchen." Yeah, I just found it a very safe and happy place for me and what I wanted to do. From that point and tapas and, you know, the Salt Yard, which is a wonderful restaurant to start off at, I wanted to learn and, you know, go to culinary school. And at the time, all of my peers were going to, you know, France and Italy and increasingly Spain to do stages. And I thought, never mind all that, I'm going to go off to Singapore. I had an addiction to chili back then. So I went to Culinary Academy in Singapore. And the reason for that was it would be a place where everyone spoke English, and there was Malaysian food, Chinese food, Indonesian food, like, but all of the cuisines of Southeast Asia are condensed and easy to get to, you know, hawker centers all over the place. So that's why I went to Singapore, and I had the most incredible time just eating my way around Singapore.
Have you found that professional kitchens are run differently in different areas of the world, or is there a sort of common theme that runs through them?
I think they're run differently. I mean, talking about Trishner as an example, I went there on a stage because I'd been to a restaurant called Trishner in Mumbai, which is famous for this butter crab dish. Now, so there was one in London, which I went to start basically to pinch their crab recipe and be able to cook it myself. And that kitchen was beautifully quiet. There wasn't all of this shouting and swearing and, you know, stress at all, because if you're good at what you do, like these chefs in that restaurant, been doing it since they were kids, there's no need to shout. There's no need to get stressed. So that kitchen was very, very calm and peaceful in how service was organized. I think you only really get that kind of thing, what you're used to now, is when people are spinning out in the kitchens and they start swearing, shouting and doing all that kind of stuff. In Thailand, it's like if you lose your cool, that's it. You know, it's like you have to have like a cool heart, cha yin yin. If that goes out the window, then it's not good for you or anyone else. And I think that's an important way for a kitchen to be now, to work diligently and patiently and persistently at one's craft. And in that way, you can have a happy kitchen environment.
And that then has influenced how you run your kitchens.
Well, I'd like to think so. I mean, we do get a bit stressed.
There's a balance. But, there's a balance to be struck.
There's definitely a balance there, yeah. And we're trying a lot of things that in Thailand are easy to do. And they're second nature to a Thai chef. And in London, despite my training and immersion into Thai culture and cuisine, are still difficult things to master. There's a complexity with the supply, with London restaurants, as they are, how they have to be machines to make a margin that plays heavily on my heart and how we do the cooking. But always have to remember where it comes from and what we're actually aiming to do food-wise.
And Luke, tell us, I mean, you've obviously travelled extensively across Southeast Asia. Tell us about how you ended up settling on Thai food and how that then led into the ingredients you're growing in your greenhouses.
Well, I suppose it is Thai food, really, because the two restaurants that now are in London are Thai. But I was really all over Southeast Asia. I have a business selling cooking equipment online, and I sell woks, hand-hammered woks from China, these volcanic pestle and mortars from Indonesia. I used to work in Indonesia for a fair trade company and selling into garden centres as well. So I've always been in that part of the world, just most naturally. And the food is a huge part of that, and it's a huge part of doing business over there as well. I think the reason I settled on Thailand, or perhaps I'm most familiar with Thailand, is because I learned the language. I'm learning the language now. If you speak a little bit of Thai, the country opens up like a beautiful flower. It's wonderful how receptive Thai people are to just a few words. And I think that really encouraged me when I first went to Thailand. And, you know, you the more effort you put in, the more you get out with that sort of thing, with language learning. It's really important for chefs that are involved in a cuisine that is not from where they're from, that they take the time to learn to speak the language, or at least have a go. And that can mean reading recipe books, which I do a lot in Thai. That helped me a lot to read Thai script. You can see the picture and go, oh, look, that's garlic kratiam. Then you can read the Thai underneath. So that helps a lot. And again, when you're in a restaurant, how to order. That's a great skill, because you can eat like Thai people rather than eating what they think foreigners would enjoy. There's a hospitality in Thailand that sometimes gets the better of you. I'll put it like that.
And Luke, I thought it was interesting that you mentioned you haven't cooked pad Thai for a while, because I suppose lots of British listeners might think that that is the kind of archetypal Thai dish. I mean, how does the Thai food that we have in the UK compare to what you've encountered and what you're trying to do at your restaurants?
Well, I think the Thai food that we do at Speedboat Bar and Plaza is as you would find it in Thailand. That's really all that we're trying to do. And that is a challenge, which I relish. It's the same with the greenhouses. You know, it's very easy to grow herbs in Thailand in the field or in your back garden. But when you're growing them in the UK with low light levels and heating bills and you know, the cost of it. It's an added complexity, which I kind of like. I don't know. I enjoy all of that. I think that it's exciting to be able to transplant a cuisine from one country to the other and try and do it in the best possible way. The curry paste, for example, are shipped from Pattalung in southern Thailand for Plaza. What that means is that they're correct. Where you could have a person in the UK pounding a curry paste, it would be very expensive to do that. The ingredients they would be using would be flown in from Thailand anyway before being pounded, and they wouldn't be fresh. And also they wouldn't have the experience of a third generation curry shop in southern Thailand. So that's why we do it like that. And the main reason for it is it means that we can't cheat with those pastes, with that level of chili heat, the correct southern Thai turmeric, long pepper in some of the pastes, and everything from that particular area makes for a dish that we can't dumb down or dilute in any way in the restaurant. The same with our fresh coconut milk. We make our own fresh coconut milk because that's how it would be done in southern Thailand. And we do the same in our restaurant. The vegetables coming up from my greenhouse are the same that you would find in Thailand, albeit fresher and not flown over. That's an example of the type of thing we're trying to achieve at Plaza. With Speedboat Bar, it's more of a Chinese style, or this cuisine of Yarra, which is Bangkok's Chinatown. That's not meant to say it's any less complex, but there's more emphasis there on sauces, like, for example, oyster sauce and soy sauce, as well as, you know, roasted meats and noodles. The noodles that we use come from Lowe's Noodle Factory in Chinatown, which is an institution. That made sense there. We also imported our own Thai soy sauce from Betong in southern Thailand, made in the traditional way. So all these things come together to sort of build that story of a restaurant that is of Thailand. It's too easy to get a tin of coconut milk and a pre-prepared paste and bosh it together and have red curry, orange curry, green curry. I think that those days are over, really. I think people have traveled more. They're more used to Thai food and they're more used to a vernacular type of cuisine rather than what they're fed as tourists. And I think that's nothing but a good thing.
And can you tell us a bit about the Speedboat Bar? There's a kind of speedboat theme to it. Can you tell listeners about that? Because they might not be aware of this as a sport, yeah, in Thailand.
Yeah, they're like waterborne piston heads, right? They're like the Hell's Angels of the Klongs and canals in Thailand. And it's these tiny wooden boats, you know, like tea trays with these massive engines on the back, all chromed out and thumping away there, all the fumes and stuff, and massive exhausts on the back. And it's a sport in Thailand that is of tradition and the waterways, the Venice of the East, all of that, but updated to present times with all of the neon and the excitement and the speed. And that's something I like to go and watch when I'm in Bangkok. There's a great atmosphere on the riverbank, all these boats zooming past. And there's always food nearby, you know, things like grilled pork on skewers, doing a little barbecue set up on the side of the river, or some hot pot dish with the coals inside bubbling away, or just some like seafood, like prawns or like crab, you know, gengsong curry, that sort of thing. And I thought that it would be interesting to have that. I love it, and I wanted the boats over in the restaurant. I thought it would be good fun. And as it looks like a Chinese shop house, Speedboat Bar itself, you often find that it would be set up as a restaurant and then the living quarters would be upstairs. Now, very often now with these Thai Chinese families, or Thai families, should we say, that yes, the downstairs is still a restaurant, but the upstairs is more of the younger generation's interests. You know, so it could be like a bar, or it could be like a clubhouse for a sport they like, or it could be, you know, pool tables up there or whatever. We wanted to do the same thing in London. So where downstairs is quite sort of utilitarian and stainless steel tables and basically like a shop house that you could, you know, wash out with a hose at the end of the night like they do in Thailand, upstairs would be more of a sort of clubhouse vibe. And also to be able to go from the first floor up to the second floor and get the difference, I thought was quite exciting too.
And tell us about the greenhouses. How long have you had them for?
Well,
The greenhouses started from my dad, really, and the butterflies. We have lots of butterflies flying around there. We own the Stratford-upon-Avon Butterfly Farm and have a partnership with Butterfly World in Florida, as well as assisting in Entopia in Penang in Malaysia, which my dad helped set up with my Malaysian uncle all those years ago. So the greenhouses were for butterfly food plants, but I was sneaking herbs back and cuttings and seeds and putting them in there. And my dad's head gardener was growing them for me. And then I would go and pinch them and, you know, cook up a curry or something, and, you know, or a stir fry or a pak krapow with the Thai basil. And it was actually my dad that took some to the NAM in London at the Halkin Hotel when David Thompson had a restaurant there. And I think his book, Thai Food, is probably one that every aspiring Thai chef should own. It's a Bible of sorts for Thai cuisine outside of Thailand. And he took him a box of herbs and he was like, well, we want more of this. So it started from there, really. And I went to Thailand and met up with David's head chef at NAM in Bangkok, Adam Lee Cliff. And we went to a plant market and just raided the place for everything that he wanted to grow in my greenhouses. And let's just say somehow they ended up in my greenhouse in the UK. And a lot of the plants still from that stock today, like the lemongrass, for example, has been transplanted and separated hundreds of times. It's gone down to other growers further down in Cornwall and in the southwest, which is a wonderful thing. So it's not just supplying my own restaurants. So yeah, that, and now we need it for us. I used to supply to some of the people that used to cook for David Thompson, restaurants like Kiln and Smoking Goat and Begging Bowl, to name a few, Farang as well. But now that they have their own suppliers, which is great. And we supply ourselves now at Speedboat Bar and Plaza. Yeah, with the herbs that wherever we can. So at this time of year, I'm now adjusting what we're growing in the greenhouse to fit the menu for this year. So that coming into, you know, March, April, May, we've got plants coming through. We've got, you know, gourds and, you know, citrus working. So then further into the summer, we've got our setup for all of our Thai basil and holy basil. We've got then things like Southern Thai turmeric, which we're going to have in a soup at Plaza. So it's about designing the greenhouses around the restaurants now. Whereas before, it was whatever popped up in the greenhouse, I just cook with it. Now it's taking a lot more planning to make sure that we can offer exciting ingredients and the correct ones in Southern Thai and Central Thai cuisine.
That must be immensely satisfying as a chef and gardener and curator of vegetables and herbs, to be able to bring all those things together and give an authentic experience.
I think it's, for me, it's the most important thing. There's only a handful of suppliers that deal in Thai produce in London, and they sell to the majority of the restaurants. So what you're getting is the same across the board. To add into the mix ingredients that are grown in the UK in tropical greenhouses where possible, is a great thing. And they don't have to be done in tropical greenhouses. You know, at certain times of year, they can be done in polytunnels or even outside with some of the Thai tomatoes and chilies later in the year. And I'm always encouraging people to do that, because it makes Thai food so much more vibrant and correct as well. You know, it's a cuisine based on fresh ingredients rather than dried spices. So that's why they're so essential.
Luke, when you're cooking for yourself at home, what do you tend to cook? Do you cook a lot of South Asian food or not?
Yes, I never stop with it, really. Just walking around in the greenhouse, I'm like, oh god, I better use that. I got it. That needs to be used somewhere. Sometimes I'll cook something for myself, and then with the rest of it, I'll be like, right, we've got to box this up, send it straight out to the restaurant. Got to have it on the menu immediately, which drives the chefs mad. But it can be difficult sometimes in a London restaurant to be spontaneous and to put specials on. There's a whole machine that needs to work in order for a dish to come on the menu. So jamming something into the works now and again it's become a bit of my speciality, really. But yeah, and I cook at home, and then I'll send, you know, I'll, I'll send the chefs the picture and say, how about this? And they'll moan and groan. Then I come up to London with it and cook it for them. And then we'll all sit down and eat it. And then hopefully it'll get on the menu, that sort of thing. So it's always playing into the restaurants for me. It's simple things, really. With the time I've got now, I cook like a pack of power, go and get a handful of basil and chilies, garlic, coriander root, bash them up and have that with some beef or pork, and just on rice with a fried egg. My chickens are laying again now, so that's always a lovely thing to do. Often I sit down with my family, and, you know, we go through the menu, what I've made and what's come from the garden. You know, oh, look, this is our own rye water beef. This is our own egg from the chickens we've got. This is our own holy basil, our own chilies, our own coriander, our own garlic. Yeah, just short of making fish sauce. we're getting there, yeah.
You've obviously always been an adventurous and a confident eater. Is there anything you don't like?
There is one thing. It's my Achilles heel, and it's really annoying because I've tried so many times. Raw oysters, I just can't eat them. Yeah, I had a bad experience. Yeah, I had half a dozen at Kensington Place, and then I went to a house party and downed some tequila. And that was it. I was up and down from bathroom to bathroom with that. It really stitched me up. And I have eaten them raw in the past, but I've always, that experience, I'm not allergic, but that experience just makes me heave.
Can you still drink tequila?
But no, not the tequila, weirdly. Yes, the oysters. Yeah. I'll have, I don't like tequila, but I'll have them steamed in Thailand. And I eat oyster omelets as well. It's one of my favorite things to eat. They have these sort of quite small, they look more like mussels, really. They're not like kind of all over the place. They're kind of little globs of mussels, which pop with this sort of saline sea flavor. They're incredible.
And Luke, thank you very much. Just to finish on, we normally like to ask our guests what their desert island meal would be. It's sort of a kind of what would your last meal be question, but we find that seems a bit morbid. So what would be your ultimate meal?
Gosh, that's difficult. My ultimate meal. I think it would be fish head curry. I know we talked about it before, but there's something, if it is your last meal, then something which you can really get into and block everything else out, I think would be a lovely thing to have. And fish head curry takes a bit of work to eat. There's lots of different elements on it. I think that's exciting in food, and something you have to do a little bit of work for is interesting. Also, I like the fact that if someone, you know, said this is your last meal and I demanded that, I might get to live a little longer.
And would you have a drink alongside it?
I'd have a very large glass of Jameson's on the rocks.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Luke, that was fantastic. Thank you so much for joining Table Talk.
Thank you very much for having me.